This week marks the 200th anniversary of the Louisiana Purchase. In Talking History's Fred Nielsen provides us with some history of the event with his guest, John Kukla.
200 years ago, the United States bought the Louisiana Territory from France. In one of history's greatest bargains, the price was only 4 cents an acre, the U.S. had suddenly and peacefully doubled its size. With me to discuss the purchase and its significance is John Kukla. He has been director of the Historic New Orleans Collection and is currently director of the Patrick Henry Memorial Foundation. John Kukla is the author of A Wilderness So Immense, The Louisiana Purchase and the Destiny of America. Mr. Kukla, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Americans had their eyes on Louisiana a long time before they bought it in 1803. What was the attraction?
Louisiana, and particularly New Orleans, so they were more interested in New Orleans than they were in Louisiana, stands at the mouth of the Mississippi River and therefore controls the flow of trade, particularly down the Ohio River. And so after the American Revolution, as Americans were moving across the Appalachians and into Kentucky particularly, and then Tennessee and later Ohio, the trade route going downriver, down the Ohio to the Mississippi, became critically important and gave New Orleans its strategic importance and economic importance.
One of the Americans who's specifically interested in New Orleans and Louisiana was George Rogers Clark, mm-hmm. who might be perhaps better known as the brother of William Clark, one of the co-leaders of the Lewis and Clark expedition.
That's right.
What was George Rogers Clark's interest in Louisiana?
His initial interest, of course, came in the Revolution when he was essentially holding down the West for the American patriots. And then he's involved in a very interesting episode that I tell about in the book and that, frankly, I hadn't known about. When Citizen Genet is the French representative to the United States, Genet tries to enlist Clark. This is in 1793. Tries to enlist Clark in an expedition to conquer Louisiana under a French flag. And Jefferson is actually at one point up to his ears in this, and then pulls back from it. And Genet, for various reasons, falls out of favor with the French and also with the Washington administration, and is eventually recalled. And so nothing comes of this. But Clark's interest in securing the watershed and the prosperity of the West it develops early on and is sustained through the 90s.
So had Clark had his way, and Jefferson too, perhaps, who's Secretary of State when this is happening, mm-hmm. the United States might have actually acquired it by force rather than by purchase?
Yeah, that would be a very, very real possibility. In fact, I think as I look at the thing, if Citizen Genet had been more efficient in supplying Clark with the go-ahead and some money early on, I think it's entirely likely that George Rogers Clark and a group of Kentuckians would have simply captured New Orleans in 1793, and that had been the end of it.
Jefferson, as you pointed out, is deeply involved in these diplomatic and ultimately military shenanigans in the 1790s. Mm-hmm. Although for a very long time, he had hoped, at least in some sort of theoretical way, that the Western Territory could be part of what he called an empire of liberty.
Yeah.
I'm curious about that. Empire and liberty, those words seem at odds with each other. What did Jefferson mean by that phrase?
You know, I'm glad you bring that up because we're so accustomed to seeing that phrase and seeing it celebrated as though it's a... And it's really an oxymoron. It really is a contradiction in terms. And imperialism and liberty are at odds. And you know, one of the sub themes that I try to develop a little bit in this book, in fact, is the problem of Republicans, small r, you know, Republicans of the Revolution who were very much influenced by Montesquieu and his belief that republics had to stay small. And there was a great fear on the part of a number of serious Americans, John Jay vocally among them, that it wasn't a good idea for the United States to expand across the Appalachian because it would make the place too big and it would succumb to all the temptations of becoming an empire. And in some ways, as we look back over the last 200 years since the Louisiana Purchase, there's some reason to see it as a forerunner of our involvement, for example, a century later in the Philippines and that sort of thing. I think Jefferson's phrase would have worked better He first writes it actually in a letter to George Rogers Clark during the Revolution. He first uses that phrase, Empire of Liberty. I think what he really meant was an empire for liberty, and his hope was that by expanding westward, that the United States would be able to bring democratic institutions and kind of the American way of life to areas that he regarded as being controlled by old world nations, whether it was Spain, England, or France, and that therefore this was a good thing.
The old world nations, of course, had it before. In fact, it kept changing hands. The Americans bought Louisiana in 1803 from the French, who had gotten it just a couple of years before from the Spanish.
Right.
How'd the French acquire it, and why so soon after they got it did they, in effect, give it away?
France, particularly Napoleon and to some extent Talleyrand, who was at that time his principal foreign minister, Bonaparte wanted to own Louisiana in order to use the plantations and farms of Louisiana to supply foodstuffs, fuel, lumber, and all kinds of basic commodities to the island of Saint-Domingue, which is now Haiti. And what he wanted to do basically was to reestablish slavery in Saint-Domingue, reestablish the sugar plantation economy in Saint-Domingue, which had had a phenomenal importance in French commerce and international trade. He wanted to reestablish the sugar colony of Saint-Domingue. To do that, he thought that it would be a good idea to have Louisiana as a place basically to supply all the kinds of commodities that it wasn't worthwhile setting aside labor or land in Saint-Domingue to create or to grow. And so when the he pressed Spain to give Louisiana back to France in a secret treaty in 1800, but then when the expedition, the French expedition to reestablish control over Saint-Domingue and reestablish slavery, when it foundered and then just became a complete disaster, something like 54,000 out of 60,000 men were dead at the end of it. When that failed, his reason for wanting to own Louisiana suddenly evaporated as well, and he was more interested in going back to war with Great Britain and needed the money, and so was ready to sell.
In one of history's great fire sales, he puts it on the market to the Americans.
That's right.
You write that Robert Livingston made the deal for Louisiana and that James Monroe, the future president, saved it. What were their contributions?
Livingston had been in... Livingston was sent as Jefferson's ambassador to France right after Jefferson's inauguration. So he'd been in France for a couple of years prior to the crisis that inspired Jefferson to send James Monroe as a special ambassador. And during that time, Livingston worked really hard, and my book sort of tells that story, traces those stories, to try to make the case for American possession, particularly what they wanted was New Orleans, and they wanted West Florida, which is those parts of the toe of the boot of Louisiana and those parts of Mississippi and Alabama that stick down to the coast. That's what the United States was really interested in, even when Monroe went over. So what happened is, for about 2 years, Livingston is doing everything he can to promote this idea, and I think pretty successfully. Then, after the closing of the river on October 16th, 1802, when this becomes a crisis that really sort of hits the fan in December and January when news reaches Washington, Jefferson sends Monroe to bolster the mission and to try to buy some time, essentially. And Monroe arrives as Livingston is essentially putting the final touches on the negotiations with Barbe Marbois and Talleyrand and through them with Napoleon. So what Monroe does is he shows up, and of course he's terribly important because he demonstrates Jefferson's taking this seriously, but by that time Livingston has really done all the heavy lifting. And what happens then later, after the treaty, Monroe's involved in the negotiations during the month of April, and gets kind of a false sense that he's playing a bigger role than he really was, because of course he didn't witness all that Livingston had done before. But anyway, after the treaty is signed and sent back to the United States, that next summer, Napoleon starts to have second thoughts, and at that point he wants some money, and James Monroe is the one who really knows Jefferson's mind. He's been the one that spent time with Jefferson most recently. He's a very, very close friend. And he's the only one probably in the world, essentially, who could say, we've got $2 million, let's give it to him, even though the deal is in jeopardy, and know that he'd be backed and supported by the president when he went back. So in that transaction, James Monroe saves the deal, which I think basically Livingston made. Now, what happens, the next thing that happens is that Livingston and Monroe both write to Jefferson and say, essentially, ratify the treaty as quickly as possible. And at that point, Jefferson gives up all his thoughts of trying to write an amendment to the Constitution or have public debate about it, and he pushes it through the Senate without any debate whatsoever, simply because it's in jeopardy.
And he does push it through. Interestingly, the purchase was not at the time universally acclaimed. You write that there were some Northern Federalists, in particular, members of the opposition party to Jefferson, who even talked of leaving the United States. What were their objections to Louisiana?
Their objections to Louisiana were several. One was that they recognized the likelihood that this territory in the West would ally itself politically with the Southern states, and that therefore, particularly the New England states, would find themselves to be a minority, outvoted in Congress. Those animosities actually develop as early as 1785 and 6, before the writing of the Constitution. And, you know, I tell some of that story in the book. It's one that people have, a couple of scholars have sensed was there, but it turns out to have more substance to it than people thought. So those sectional animosities between the so-called carrying states to the north and the productive states to the south are part of the dynamic that goes into the ratification and writing of the Constitution and such. So those animosities are there. And what happens with the Louisiana Purchase is suddenly Jefferson's having this enormous expansion of the country, and their, being the New Englanders, expectation is that this is not good for them in terms of politics. It's also, some of these guys go back to this notion of Montesquieu, that a republic can't be that big, and that it can't be as diverse in interest. Slavery is not the kind of issue that it becomes later with the rise of abolitionism after 1820, but there is this feeling on the part of the New Englanders, particularly, that they are basically different, and that they'd be better off in a smaller New England republic, and they start agitating for that. It's the same sentiment that comes up again in the War of 1812 and leads to the Hartford Convention of 1814. So for 40 years, this pattern of New Englanders thinking about seceding is a part of American politics that I think we're not so aware of as we are of the post-1820 inclination on the part of the Southern states to consider secession.
The New Englanders, as you've said, thought of themselves as different, but there was no question that Louisiana was different too.
Yeah, and that's part of, I mean, what they don't like, in addition to the, you know, sort of power politics in Congress, and the fact that, I mean, Fisher Ames, a notable American Federalist from Massachusetts, is constantly complaining about Jefferson being a Negro president, by which he means that the three-fifths clause of the Constitution, you know, the way it plays out in the Electoral College, gives added votes to the Southern states, and therefore put, you know, Jefferson in office. And they don't like that. The New Englanders don't like that. They see themselves as being sort of boxed into a minority role within the nation. And they also do not like the fact that the United States is expanding into an area where there are people who are just different. You know, French, Spanish, the racial mix of Louisiana is different. These are people who were brought up, as they would say at the time, these are people who brought up under despotism, are unfamiliar with American ways, and it's an open question in their mind, and actually in Jefferson's mind as well, and in the mind of many in Congress, as to whether or not the people of Louisiana can participate as citizens in a republic. Jefferson uses the language of describing them sort of as infants, who need to be trained, and in fact, when you look at the history of the state of Louisiana, it's not admitted to the Union until 1812. It takes that long for people to, you know, to sort of sort through these feelings about admitting an alien population into the republic.
You quote one prominent historian who said that no event in American history, not the Civil War, or the Declaration of Independence, or even the signing of the Constitution, was more important than the Louisiana Purchase. I wonder how you yourself, having studied it, would assess the significance of the purchase.
I think actually that quote from Bernard DeVoto is pretty close to the mark. The thing that I found fascinating, I guess, when I got into writing this book was to see all the ramifications of the importance of the Mississippi, the importance of New Orleans, and ultimately the importance of the Louisiana Purchase in ways that people just hadn't fully recognized. There's a wonderful history by a friend of mine of the early American economic system, for example, published about 15 years ago, 20 years ago, that gives the Louisiana Purchase only a paragraph. And, you know, when you look in textbooks, it's something that suddenly surprises you. It just happens, and then it's over, and then we go on to the rest of American history. And when you look at, I guess when you play out in your mind what the alternatives might have been, we could very well have ended up with a continent that was balkanized into a whole bunch of little nations. You know, we think of ourselves as a peaceful nation, and yet we've had wars. War of 1812 involved Canada. The Mexican War involved Mexico. Had we had more nations, there certainly would have been more wars. There's all kinds of ways in which we just take the results of the Louisiana Purchase for granted to such an extent that we can't imagine the continent looking different, and we can't imagine American history looking different. And as a result, I think its importance is kind of hidden, it's so obvious that it's hidden from view, if that makes any sense.
It's the purloined purchase rather than the purloined letter.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Kukla, thank you so much for visiting with us.
My pleasure.
I've been talking with John Kukla, the author of A Wilderness So Immense, The Louisiana Purchase and the Destiny of America.